We're in Genesis 32 this evening. And Genesis 32 is a little different chapter than what we've run into lately in the life of Jacob. What we've seen in Jacob's life is a man who's really full of deception. We've seen that with when he dealt with his brother Esau and deceived him in tricking him out of his birthright. And then, of course, when he dealt with his father deceiving him and receiving the covenant blessing. And then Esau was extremely mad, and so his mother had to send him off to live with his uncle Laban, and then dealing with Laban and deceiving him numerous times and being deceived by Laban, his uncle. And then, of course, leaving in a big hurry from his uncle Laban's house after 20 years, more or less in the middle of the night type of a situation where he takes off without saying goodbye because he's in fear of what Laban would do if he tried to leave. So we are at that point of the story where he's dealt with Laban and he's on his way and he's to the point where he's entering back into the land of Canaan, the promised land. And so we're really at a pivotal chapter in the life of Jacob. And what you find is that he's a different man in this chapter from the Jacob that you've known before, or at least this is the chapter that really changes him. And in a lot of people's lives, if you look back over the course of your own life, I suppose, not everybody's like this, but oftentimes people look back over the course of their lives and from the person you are today to where you came from, oftentimes there's a point that you can say, well, this is what changed me, or this is a time when I went through a great amount of change that brought me to where I am today. Well, this is it for Jacob. So, and this is the time of his change. So, Jacob's been gone from Canaan for 20 years, and he's headed back to the land of his birth, back to meet with his father. He doesn't know if his mother's still alive, but he's pretty sure that his brother's still alive, of course. And he fears his brother because he doesn't know that his brother has forgiven him for all the things that he has done to Esau. And Jacob had left Canaan for Haran to live with Laban, of course, Jacob had made basically an agreement with God for what turned out to be safety and provision. That in Genesis 28, verse 20 through 22, Jacob vowed a vow saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that the Lord, or so that I come again into my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." That was, of course, at Bethel. And so, really, that was more of deal-making with God than anything else. A lot of people make that kind of deal with God. Lord, if you'll do this, then I'll do that. That sort of thing. If you'll, many people do that when they're drunk, or in jail or something of that nature, have gotten themselves into a bind or in some kind of life crisis. Jacob made this kind of a deal with God. Now, does that really exhibit some kind of extreme faith in God or anything else? Not really. you know, sort of a let's make a deal type of thing. But that was the that was really the last time that God or that Jacob dealt with angels. It's a interesting kind of thing that he saw the angels going up and down the ladder, you know, Jacob's ladder. And this is going to be a chapter where we deal quite a bit with angels again. As he left Canaan, the land of Canaan, and entered into Haran, he dealt with angels. But now as he enters into the land of Canaan, he's met by angels once again. And so as we start chapter 32, Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host," and he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And that means two camps. So there was more than one angel, and apparently they were split up. And from the standpoint of security, of course, he's afraid of Esau. And Jacob is at this point a rich man with lots of herds, and he has the two wives, the two maid servants, and 11 sons, and we don't know how many daughters are there, but there are daughters. And fearing Esau and everything, so what Jacob does is he decides to go ahead and send a messenger, you know, sort of a scout type of thing, to feel out the situation before he sends, you know, goes ahead with anybody important. And so he sends a messenger ahead to speak with Esau. And in verse 3, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And the message was really one of peace and subordination on Jacob's part. And one that really said that I have prospered, and that I don't have any need of anything that you have. You know, in other words, we're not here to try to take any of your goods. We're not here to pillage you or anything like that. We're not here to make an offensive attack or anything. We don't have any need of anything that you have. We're just here in peace. And so that was really the message that he sent. So he, verse 4, commanded them, saying, "Thus shall ye speak unto my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob." So you notice language. Make sure you, when you speak to my older brother Esau, you know, say, "thy servant Jacob." You know, which of course puts Jacob in a subservient light to his older brother. "Thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now." So, you know, it's not as though I've been out raping and pillaging. I haven't, been wandering across the world or anything. I've been with family. You know, as Laban is your uncle too, and so I've been with family for the last 20 years. And I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there all these years. So, you know, your uncle Laban and my uncle Laban have accepted me all these years. And I have oxen and asses, flocks, and men servants and women servants. And so I have all these things, and have need of nothing that is yours. And I have sent to tell my lord, that I may find grace in thy sight. So again, you see the language. He calls Esau my lord. And, you know, so he takes a very subservient and position, so that I may find grace in thy sight. That, you know, I'm just here to be your servant, and I'm here to be, you know, at your service, basically. So the servants go out, and the messengers go out, and they find Esau, but they come back with a report that is quite alarming. And the report is that Esau is on the way, but he's also on the way with 400 men. So the first assumption is, that Esau does know that Jacob's on the way, but Esau has held a grudge for at least 20 years, and because Jacob's on the way, well, he's gathered his band of men, and he's on the way to attack and kill Jacob and take everything that he has. And that would be the first assumption. And, you know, Esau has a small army there. And so the messengers return, verse 6, to Jacob, saying, we came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him. And so, you know, that's a small army to us, but that's a huge army in the eyes of Jacob. You know, he has men servants and maid servants and everything, but he's not going to arm the sheep and the cows. He's greatly outnumbered at that point. So, you know, what's he got to think? What's fresh in Jacob's mind? He just left Laban, and the latest experience that he had was, you know, after he left Laban without saying so much as goodbye, you know, Laban gathered up his men and hunted Jacob down. And, you know, if you remember, Laban says, you know, I can kill you if I wanted to. And the only thing saving your neck is the fact that God says, don't touch him. You know, don't do anything. And that's the only reason I'm not killing you right now. And so, you know, Jacob really escaped with just by the skin of his teeth in that adventure. And I'm sure that's fresh in his mind. And now here comes Esau with an even greater force than what Laban had. Well, the language that's already been used, you can tell that Jacob is not trying to deceive in any way. He's not trying to pull one over on Esau or anything. He's rather just trying to be forthright and you know, bow down to his brother. Trying to, you know, just, I'm sorry for what happened. You know, what happened is behind us, and I'm trying to apologize for it. So he is becoming a different man, using grace and all that in his manner, trying to take Esau's feelings into account and all that. But meanwhile, the fact of the matter is there's 400 men plus what Jacob interprets as a mad brother on the way to kill him. And so, if you remember, there was the angels that met Jacob, and they were in two camps. And Jacob interprets this as sort of a message or a sign from God. And he says, well, you know what? They were split up, so we ought to do the same thing. And it's pretty good military strategy, really, because when Esau gets here, if he finds us, well, he'll get part of us, but he won't get us all. Some of us will escape. So rather than all stay together, because we can't fight him, even if we do all stay together, we'll split up, and part of us will get away, even if some of us don't make it. So in verse 7 there, then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks, and the herds, and the camels, into two bands, and said, if Esau come to one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape. So there was no hope of fighting or anything else, but rather just the hope that one of the companies that was separated would get away. So Jacob's intent is rather pure here. And the only real hope that Jacob has is gone. He realizes that, you know, we can't fight, we can't run, we can't, there's absolutely nothing, I can't go back to Laban. There's nothing I can do here. I'm out of options. God is my only hope in this case. And so, what do? Pray. Because what did God say Well, I'm going to be with you. Go home, back to Canaan, and I will be with you, was the promise of God. And so, in verse 9, Jacob does, in fact, do sort of a foxhole prayer, pretty intently, and it's a short prayer. And he recognizes his unworthiness in the whole situation, and the desperation of the situation, and says, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which saidest unto me, return unto thy country and go to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee, I am not worthy. So, you know, he starts addressing the God and God and what he had said. But then he goes on and admits, I am not worthy of the least of all thy mercies, and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now am become two bands. Well, in that second verse of the prayer of Jacob is something quite remarkable that we haven't seen from Jacob in all the things that we've read about him in the past. In the past, everything that we have known about Jacob is that he was always self-sufficient in everything. No matter what was put in front of him, he was always able to overcome it by his own cunning. When Rachel was there, he made a deal with Laban to work for 7 years. When Laban got the better of him, by Leah showing up in the marriage tent, well, okay, I'll work another 7 years for Rachel, but then I'll get the better of Laban at the end of that 7 years by getting the flocks of Laban with the striped rods. And so he did. The Laban's flocks dwindled down. And that because of Jacob theoretically manipulating the genetics of the flocks of Laban. And so, you know, Jacob always thought that no matter what happened, he could, by his own efforts, overcome any obstacle by himself. And here he's finally come to the conclusion that he has run up against an obstacle that he cannot overcome himself. And it's much like when somebody comes to the realization of the point where they need Christ for their salvation. They've gone through life there's a sinner, and then they've lived life in the fast lane, and they've done this, they've done that, and all these things, realizing that I'm not a great person, but I'm better than that guy or this, that, the other thing, and whatever circumstances surround their life, at some point they come to a point where they realize that there's nothing that they can bring to the table. There's nothing that they can bring to the party at all. There's nothing that they're worthy of. They're just lower than pawn scum. And if they're going to be saved, it's not going to be because of anything that they can bring of themselves. And that's the point where Jacob is at this time. So when he says, I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant, he at this time recognizes and acknowledges to God all the things that I did in the past were wrong. And all the truths that you showed me were, you were right, God. I was wrong. All the things that I did were wrong. I mean, just like someone who's at the point of getting saved. So, then in verse 11, he says, deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. For I fear him, lest he will come and smite me, and the mother with the children. So this is a prayer very much like someone would, who is coming to the point of salvation and says, deliver me from hell. So this is very similar in its circumstance. In the last verse, verse 12 here, and thou saidest, I will surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Jacob stands on the promise that was given to not just him, but to his father and to Abraham. So he's standing on the promises of God, the same way that anyone who is saved also stands on the promises of those who went before. Just, the promise that Christ rose from the dead and those who believe will also be saved. I mean, it's not a unique promise here, just unique to Jacob. So this isn't one promise that's unique just to Jacob. But thou saidest, I will surely do thee good, and will make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. That wasn't unique to Jacob. It was given to his daddy also, and to his granddaddy, Abraham, just as the promise of salvation by grace through faith has been given to multitudes of people before you and I got here. So this whole prayer here is really a pattern of a prayer of coming to and realizing the need for salvation. But meanwhile, the reality is Esau's still on his way. Esau is still on his way. Just as in life, you can realize the need for salvation, you can ask the Lord for salvation, but Esau is still on his way. The problems of life go on. And so Esau and his 400 men are still coming. So Jacob has to deal with Esau. And he has to deal with Esau in the utmost of grace. In the utmost of grace. I was on the internet. I can't remember exactly what I was that I was reading about, but there was comments at the bottom, and somehow the comments got off track, and it got off onto the age of the universe. And you all know that I'm a believer in young Earth, and God created everything 6,000 years ago. Well, I don't know that anybody in the comments section believe that, but there was one particular person who just kept arguing, that the universe is 14 billion years old, and the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and there is no God and all this. And there was somebody on there that was obviously a Christian and just had infinitely much more patience than I did. And as I read through the comment thread, I was just extremely impressed. I guess that's the word to use. Because this particular person used the same strategy that Jacob is about to use in his comments. No matter what the unbeliever said, the Christian came back with nothing but infinite grace and compliments and the person would say something, and the Christian would say, "Well, no doubt you're right." You know, the scientists may say that, and the Christian would say, "Well, you know, I've read that scientists say that," and the Christian would say, "Well, you know, he would dispute that," and the Christian would come back and say, "Well, no doubt you're right. You know, and you're much more intelligent than them, and you're much more knowledgeable about the subject than I am." And would keep complimenting that person about their scientific knowledge, but then continue to make his point about God. And at the end, I mean, he would just keep working toward, you know, moving toward the final destination of that God created the heavens and the earth, which he ultimately did. And in the end, left the unbeliever without room to compliment or comment, because he complimented him so highly that the unbeliever was just flabbergasted at the other end of the computer somewhere, and probably just threw his hands up and shut off the machine. Because the Christian just complimented so much and said, you know, I'll pray for you and I'll keep you in my prayers, and it's just continued to compliment and was just overjoyed by the fact that, you know, he was such a wonderful person and everything else, but continued to stay on subject that God created the heavens and the earth and make his point. And it was such a joy to read that there wasn't an argument, but a continual moving toward of this unbeliever toward God created. Here Jacob does the same thing. Uses tremendous grace in his dealing with Esau. Jacob doesn't go to meet Esau immediately, but rather sends an emissary with gifts of animals. Here's Jacob, and he lodged there, verse 13, that same night, and took of that which came to his hand the present for Esau his brother: 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milch camels and their colts, 40 kiln and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 foals. So, in other words, there was the females and then the males to match of each kind of animal. Now, the plan here is, of each kind of animal, you take the females and then the males to match, and you'd send them with the messenger. Not all at once, but, for instance, each kind of animal, there's 200 female goats and 20 males. You'd send them in a wave, you know, and then, but the rest of the animals would stay behind. And that messenger would have all those animals, and here would be, here, you know, meet up with Esau. The message would be, this, when he saw Esau, that Jacob's behind me. These are a gift, and Jacob's behind me. Well, the fact of the matter is, Jacob was, you know, so Esau would be expecting, as soon as these animals come by, Jacob would be right behind the animals. Well, the fact of the matter is the next thing that would come would be another herd of a different kind of animals. All the females and the males to go with them, along with another servant, with the same message. These are a gift for you, Esau, from your servant Jacob. And by the way, Jacob's, you know, behind me. And so Esau would, wow, you know, and then Esau would expect Jacob to be coming behind those animals. Well, Jacob wouldn't appear behind those animals, because the next thing that would happen is another wave of animals, a different kind of animals come, the females and their males, and another servant, and the gift for Esau, and the same message Jacob was behind. And that kept coming, and just wave after wave after wave of animals. Just keep, and if you're receiving a third, what would you think? I mean, it's just like gift after gift after gift after gift after gift after gift,
If you didn't have them, you'd be thankful.
Well, yeah, it's like, when's it going to end? And you keep expecting Jacob to show up, and he never shows up. Well, let's read. So, in verse 16, and he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and he said unto his servants, pass over before me, and put a space betwixt drove and drove. So, and he commanded the foremost, saying, when Esau, my brother, meeteth thee, and asketh thee, saying, whose art thou, and whither goest thou, and whose are these before thee, then thou shalt say, they be thy servant Jacob's. It is a present sent unto my lord Esau, and behold, also, he is behind us. Well, and so commanded he the second, and the third, and all that followed the droves, saying, on this manner shall ye speak unto Esau when you find him. So all, every wave of animals did exactly the same thing, wave after wave after wave of animals. And say ye moreover, behold, thy servant Jacob is behind us, for he said, I will appease him with the present that goeth before me, and afterward I will see his face. Peradventure, he will accept of me. Now, Jacob was, he was behind him, because he stayed in the camp the whole time. Way behind him. Yes, exactly. Verse 21. So went the present over before him, and himself lodged that night in the company. So he stayed there in the camp, at the company. So, as Betty says, Jacob wasn't taking any chances. Well, it was a pretty good strategy. I mean, if you're courting a girl, if you really like her, don't send her just one bouquet of flowers. Send her 6 bouquets of flowers, 10 bouquets, really make an impression. That's right, if you make your wife mad, don't just send her one gift, keep them coming,
Don't you show up for a while.
That's right, don't you show up until they're all delivered, exactly right, not that I know by experience, but, but I've heard that works. So, well, anyway, now Moses doesn't explain why, so you can just I suppose it was prostate problem. But Jacob gets up in the middle of the night. He is 100 years old, by the way, at this point. 100 years old. So if he had to get up and relieve himself in the middle of the night, I can understand that. So he has to get up and take a little trip to the bathroom, but for whatever reason, he decides to send his wives and his maidservants and his 11 sons and all his goods that he owns over the Jabbok Creek there, on ahead of him. I guess he figured that would probably be a good idea. So in verse 22, and this is the middle of the night, he rose up that night and took his 2 wives and 2 women servants and his 11 sons. Remember, the 12th hasn't been born yet. And passed over the ford Jabbok. And he took them and sent them over the brook and sent over that he had. So he is alone. And this is when big time wrestling was invented. WWF. It used to be called big time wrestling. And in verse 24, Jacob was left alone. and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Until the breaking of the day. Now, we know for a fact, because the Bible is very good to us, that that man was an angel. We know that the man was an angel. We know all about that man, as a matter of fact. In Hosea chapter 12, starting in verse 2, we read, "The Lord hath also a controversy with Judah, and will punish Jacob." Not the man Jacob, but the nation. Yeah. "According to his ways, according to his doings, will he recompense him." But now we're referring to the man Jacob. "He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God." Now, we'll read that in just a few verses. "Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel." Now, wait a minute. When did he find him in Bethel? Remember in chapter 28? That's where we started this evening.
20 years ago.
Yeah, 20 years ago when he left the land of Canaan and he was on his way to Laban's house. That's where he met the angel. And he saw angels going up and down the ladder into heaven. So, remember Jacob's ladder? So we stopped there just briefly at the beginning of the study this evening. So, this same angel, as it turns out, was there at Bethel, where he built the altar. "And there he spake with us, even the Lord God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial." So, these verses right here in Hosea chapter 12, you're going to recognize them in just a minute. "And by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed." And then the fact that he made he wept and made supplication unto him. You're going to recognize those in those events in just a minute as we go through the chapter Genesis 32 and the events. So you're going to find out that this man that he wrestles is, in fact, an angel. But Jacob, of course, it's dark. Now, most of us live in cities these days, and of course, we have electricity. Most of us don't really know what dark looks like. I can remember when I used to drive a truck, and we went out to Montana and Wyoming, out there in the middle of nowhere, and it would get to be nighttime. Beth and I would always stop along the side of the highway and get out and look up at the sky because you could see stars that didn't even know existed. I mean, here in Ohio, you look up and you can see maybe a couple hundred stars if it's really a clear night. But out there, you would see thousands and thousands of stars. It's just, wow! Didn't know that there was that many up there, you know? And it's just astounding. Because the light pollution here is just, you don't realize that there's that much light pollution going on. Well, electricity is a nice convenience. I don't really want to start living without it, but there's a lot of light that you don't realize is around. If there aren't any lights on, it's dark. It's really dark. So, when you're out in the middle of nowhere and there's no light, you can be wrestling with somebody and not know who it is. I would have to guess that Jacob might have thought that Esau had found him and was wrestling with him. He probably thought that that's who he was wrestling with. But, so he was wrestling with him in the middle of the night. And he wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. Well, of course, as the sun's starting to come up, he can see him. And he starts to realize it's not Esau that he's wrestling with. Well, as the daylight comes, the man that he's wrestling with touches his thigh and puts his leg out of joint. Well, how many of you, I mean, I used to wrestle in school a little bit. I was never any good at it. But I never had anybody touch my thigh and put my leg out of joint. I mean, just by touching it. Nobody, you know, no natural man does that. Jacob had to have known at this point, this is not, first, Esau. Second, this is not a man. This is, you know, an angel of God. Or this is God that he's dealing with here. Well, let's read. So in verse 25, when he saw that he prevailed not against him, in other words, when the man, the angel, saw that he prevailed not against Jacob, he touched the hollow of his thigh. And the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, this is the man said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And Jacob says, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. So Jacob, what's going on is Jacob's wrestling with him. The angel touches him and puts his leg out of joint, so he can't stand on that leg anymore. He's like, ah! Well, he's hanging on to this angel. And the angel says, let go of me. He says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. So he's completely, if he's going to stand, he's completely dependent upon this angel. I mean, you know, if you got a broken leg, you're going to have a crutch or a walker or something. Well, the only thing he's got is this man. And he's hanging on him. He's completely defensive now. He's no longer putting up an offense. He's completely defensive. He's hanging on him. If he's going to stand up, he's going to hang on this guy. And that's exactly what he's doing. He's using him for a crutch. Exactly. I won't let thee go unless thou bless me. Because Jacob's unable to stand on his own. So the man asks, he says, what is thy name? Well, if you're hanging on to God and your name is Deceiver, what's the last thing you want to admit to God that you are? A deceiver. But Jacob admits it. He says, Jacob, I am a deceiver. Just like he had previously said, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant. I am a... And now he tells God, as who he's hanging on to, this is all he has to hang on to, is God. Nothing else around. Only thing he has to hang on to is God. And he tells God who he is. I am a deceiver. I'm a sinner. So he's admitting exactly who he is. God says back to him, the angel says, thy name will no more be called Jacob, or deceiver, or sinner, but rather Israel. Now, your King James Bible has the verse exactly right. You read many other verses, or many other versions, and it will read, for as a prince hast thou strived with God and with men and hast prevailed. But your King James gets it exactly right. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and has prevailed. And what's the difference? What's the difference? Well, Jacob certainly did strive with God, didn't he? He strove with God for all his life. Was that a good thing or a bad thing? It was not good. Did his striving ever come to any good at all? His striving with God? Did he, by striving with God, did he beat God down? Did he wear God out? Did God say, finally, I know, you know, God, you know what, Jacob, you worn me out and I give in? But that would really be the meaning of the verse, wouldn't it, if it says, you have strived with God and with men and you prevailed. And that's how most Bibles, and really a lot of commentaries, come to reckon with that. And many of the commentary writers are bewildered, I suppose, by the word strive. They think, I just can't get my head around how you can strive with God and prevail against God. They just can't accept that verse. And for good reason. But the King James Bible, if you look in your Strong's Concordance, the word power is in there. And it's in there in the right place. He's renamed Israel. The name Israel, meaning he will rule as God. He will rule as God. Now, that is a correct thing. He will rule as God. Because Revelation 1:6 says that we are made kings and priests by our Lord Jesus Christ. But Jacob, striving with God was never a good thing. But at some point, Jacob learned that striving with God wasn't a way to win. And he quit striving with God. And because he quit striving with God, you see, remember he said, I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. He understood the truth which God had showed to him. That all the wrong things that he did before were wrong and God was right. And so now, for as a prince, hast thou power with God and with men, and you have prevailed over the flesh, over the fleshly desires, over the fleshly strivings, over the fleshly ways of trying to deceive. You have prevailed over all those things, and you have power with God. Do we have power with God? Absolutely. Paul tells us in Romans 8:31, what shall we say then to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? That is real power with God. God is for us. Men can't be against us because God is for us. So as the verse says, you have power with God and with men. And Jacob, as a prince, had power with God. So it was the coming to the knowledge of the truth that gave Jacob the talent with God. It wasn't his striving with God that he didn't beat God at God's own game. It was rather the change in Jacob that gave him power with God. So Jacob, as he's hanging on to the angel, asks what his name is. Verse 29. Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me, I pray thee, thy name." And the angel says, "Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?" So in other words, I'm not going to tell you. And he blessed him there. Jacob confirms that the angel was more than just an angel. Not only in Hosea do we find out that the angel was in fact God. Remember in Hosea chapter 12, by his strength he had power with God. Even Hosea uses the word, by his strength he had power with God, yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. In other words, he said, I'm not going to let go of you until you bless me. And then in verse 5, the angel is called the Lord God of hosts. Well, here in verse 30, Jacob called the name of the place Peniel. Peniel is meaning for that is face to face. For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. The word preserved in the King James, another meaning for that would be saved. In other words, he was saved by this whole experience. Now, just as we would look at someone and they accept the Lord Jesus Christ as their Savior, and we would say, that person got saved today. That's the meaning of what is being said here.
What is his age?
100 years old. So in other words, we can say Jacob was 100 years old when he came to the knowledge of the truth and was saved by God. He was an unsaved man until 100 years old. He was being watched over by God. He was receiving the protection of God and the blessing of God and the provision of God, but he had not come to the saving knowledge and faith of God yet until he was 100 years old. And this is it took truly a crisis in his life where he had left Laban. So he couldn't go back. You know, Laban had come after him and said, you know what? Except God stopped me, I'm going to kill you. So he couldn't go back to Laban. He couldn't turn around. And then he's right there at the river, and he had sent messengers ahead, and now here comes Esau with 400 men, and he is greatly outnumbered. And he has to split his people in two so that if one gets slaughtered, at least half of them will survive. So he's in a desperate situation with nowhere to go. And the only thing that he has to depend on is God.
When you saw the Lord knock his hip out of the joint, he was truly dependent upon him.
Exactly. And then when he's halt with his hip out of joint and he's hanging, literally just clinging to God. That's he can't even walk. He's just hanging on God. I mean, if you can picture that in your mind.
Well, because
Mike, he couldn't stand. I mean, because when your hip is when your thigh is knocked out of its joint, you can't stand or walk. I mean, he was using that person as a support, just even be up off the ground. And said, "I'm not letting go of you until you bless me," because he knew who he was hanging on to.
If he was the wrong guy at any time, could have got him up so he could let him go and he could help us.
Well,
but he wasn't going to do that.
Well, who he was hanging on to was the pre-incarnate Son of God,
right,
in the flesh.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, that's who we know him as, Jesus Christ, who came in the flesh for our salvation. So, you know, it was the same person that Abraham talked to in the form of Melchizedek, King of Salem. So, you know, Jesus Christ shows up throughout the Old Testament, and here's another example of you know, our Lord showing up. And, you know, could God have beaten you know, Jacob in a wrestling match? Of course.
Yeah.
You know, he wrestled with him all night long, and but it was for a purpose. It was absolutely for a purpose. And it was to teach Jacob dependency on God. It was to teach Jacob dependency on God, that he cannot wrestle with God and win, as he had tried to do all his life. And many of us try to wrestle with God, and you can't do it. You cannot win at that game. It's a wrestling match that you just cannot win. You can wrestle and wrestle and wrestle until you die, but you can never win the match. So the limp is given to Jacob and remembered by the Jews as he passed over Penuel, which is the same meaning as Peniel, by the way. The sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. Therefore the children of Israel eat not the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew that shrank. So some of the things to remember from the from what we read this evening, you know, Jacob's previous victories that he thought he had won in his life, the obtaining of the birthright, the obtaining of the blessings, the covenant blessings, marriage to Rachel, the you know, the obtaining of the flocks, and the escape from Laban, and you know, all these things had all resulted in discord, in hatred, in hostility. They were all the result of striving and fleshly effort. They might have had the outcome might have been what God intended, but the means of obtaining that outcome was not a godly means. So God's blessings, you always have to remember, can only be obtained from God. We cannot obtain God's blessings ourselves, as Jacob tried to do. He tried to obtain God's blessings by manufacturing the obtaining of those things. You know, as we live the Christian life, we have to remember, as Paul points out often, that it's not a fleshly battle, it's one of spiritual warfare. And this chapter especially is a good example of that. The angels met Jacob when he entered into the land of Canaan, and The entering into the land of Canaan is really symbolic of entering into a life of faith and a life of promise in God. So you're entering into one that is going to be one that's filled with spiritual difficulties. Oftentimes, there's going to be spiritual battles to be fought. If you're outside the realm of God, you're not going to have spiritual battles to be fought because you're outside of the will of God. But inside of the will of God, there's always going to be spiritual battles to be fought, because there's going to be those who seek to take you away from the will of God. So when he entered into the land of Canaan, an angel opposed him when he tried to cross the Jabbok Brook. And you saw that. And so he had to wrestle with that angel. And we always have to remember that the blessings promised by God are spiritual blessings. And even in Jacob's case, they are spiritual blessings. They're not physical in nature. They might manifest themselves physically. You know, he prospered with flocks and sons and all those things. But the blessings themselves, the promises, are spiritual blessings. And they come upon those who believe by means of spiritual means, by faith, by God's blessing in a spiritual manner. They're not fleshly blessings, in other words. They're not there just because you're there. They're there in a spiritual capacity.
He couldn't say, "Look what I did."
Yeah, he could never say, "God, look what I did, now reward me." Exactly right. So, you know, Jacob's obstacle to obtaining the blessings of God was never Esau, or even himself. The obstacle to obtaining the blessings of God for Jacob was God, as it is for anybody. It's God. God is the arbiter, the hander outer. He is the one who has the blessings. You know, it's him and him alone. And Jacob always tried to strive to obtain blessings via carnal efforts. But God's blessings must be obtained via depending on God alone, as you saw in the lesson this evening. You know, once Jacob realized and gave up on dependence upon himself, any dependence upon himself, and fully dependent upon God, you know, was literally hanging on God, and said, "I won't let go until you give me a blessing." Then and only then were the blessings of God given. By his own effort, he was unable to obtain the blessings of God without all these bad results.
You know, you basically have to come off of your high horse and scoot down.
Well, the thing that we like to do throwing in our lives is you know, first we like to sit back and say, "I want to accomplish this," and then we go to work toward a goal. And once we get to that goal, say, "I have accomplished it." You know, and sit back and say, "Look at what I've done."
What about King Max?
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's all centered on "I have done." Instead of giving God the glory,
and depending on Him for the blessings. Now, that's not to say that we should not be actively involved, because we have to be actively involved. But our activity must be rightly directed and motivated, striving for God and His blessing on our activity. So our goals must be godly, so must our means of obtaining those goals. Jacob's goals were the same goals as God's, were they not? But his means of obtaining those goals were anything but godly. So, you know, we have to make sure not only the goals are godly. It's a great thing to say, I want to make money to give it to the charity, or give it to the church, or give it to the poor. But you know what? If you're Al Capone, and you're engaged in prostitution and drugs and robbery in order to obtain great sums of money to give to the poor, it's not a godly means of doing, of obtaining a godly goal.
Right.
So that's what Jacob was doing. He was obtaining a godly goal and an ungodly means. So both things have to be there. The godly goal has to be there, and a godly means of obtaining that goal. Yes, ma'am.
Could you use an illustration that he tried to give all these flocks of animals to buy off his brother, but really God had changed his mind?
The flocks weren't there to buy off his brother. Before he sent the flocks, his first motivation was to send the messenger with the message, I am your servant, and you are my Lord, and really sending an apology, and just saying, I have plenty of things, and I'm not here to try to harm you in any way. And it wasn't until the perceived threat of Esau coming with the 400 men that he decided to send the gifts to calm the perceived threat. The fact of the matter is that we still deal with people, and people still have emotions. Even in God's dealings with people, people are emotional. God has wrath, and God has joy, and God hates and God loves just the same way we do. So, we can give gifts to God, is it a wrong thing to give something to someone to turn them from wrath to turn away their wrath, I guess is what you'd say? Not at all. Not at all. It's not really buying them off. It's just showing your sincerity and showing your sorrow, I guess. It's like the last verses I have here, Mike, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10. He says, for though we walk in the flesh, and we walk in the flesh, we still live in this flesh, we still have to deal with the flesh, and we have to deal with others who are in the flesh. We don't war after the flesh. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through the God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing in captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. So it's spiritual warfare, no doubt. But even so, we still have to deal with others in a world where we live in a body of flesh, and so do they. And so Jacob did the right thing in showing how sincere he was in the giving of gifts and the assuaging
of any anger that Esau still had after the 20 years. Absolutely.